Vion.com. This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We have a full house here. Full house of discussion, full house of the best of the best, but we're going to talk about the best date to retire, zero COLAs again, income tax, tug of war, if any, health care reform, current federal legislation, and we just might get all this done in within the hour. And to lead us off is Mike Causey, Dean of all federal legislation before it passes, knower of all secrets. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Very much full of myself, too. Yeah.
And Tammy Flanagan, a knower of all things federal, the laws on retirement, Social Security, backdoor, not backdoors in the bad sense, but you know how to get stuff done. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
And Ann Vincent, what's your title?
Director of Business Development.
Now, she knows all the backdoors and how to meet people and get us into agencies. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Bob.
All righty, and I'm Bob Lines, and I'll find a backdoor sometime on taxes and sometimes on finances, and I'm fortunate enough to be here with three of my better friends. Anyway, Mike, I wonder, we're going to do best date to retire first.
Oh, yeah. We are? Okay.
Okay. All right. Well, I mean, that's on the list.
I'm here for. You know, seriously, this is Tammy's thing.
This is how Mike and I met.
Right. And Tammy invented this. And but, you know, who would have thought this is the best date to retire? And it is probably maybe the second, third most asked question over a one-year period, and particularly from beginning now till the end of the year, what's the best date to retire? And Tammy always figures it out, and it's always the same, but this year apparently it's different, huh?
Well, it is a little different in the fact that the calendar year ends about the same time as the leave year. And so a lot of employees who are used to picking the 3rd of January if they're under CSRS won't be using that date this year, because if they're trying to cash in a lot of annual leave, the 3rd of January will put you into the new leave year, which means you can only carry over 240. So for 2010 employees who are planning to retire this year, I would look at December 31st, which is the Friday. It's the holiday, federal holiday. January 1st holiday falls on the Friday this year. And that would be true for either CSRS or FERS employees, because it's a Friday, it's the end of the week, it's the end of the pay period, it's the end of the leave year. And so it makes it a kind of all stars lined up best date to retire if you're trying to cash in a lot of leave. And that's a lot of the times what employees are trying to do as they retire, especially these days as OPM is experiencing some backlogs in processing. It's taking on average 6 to 8 months, and they've even told agencies to prepare their employees for that length of time for processing a retirement case. And so knowing that your retirement might be delayed and you'll be in this interim partial retirement status for longer than usual, it's nice to have that lump sum annual leave check to pay your bills and kind of fill in the gaps and let the dust settle as you plan your retirement, so that, you know, it is important, I think, to cash in some annual leave so you have that to supplement those partial checks until your retirement gets up and running full steam.
Could I ask you two questions?
Sure.
In class, when I actually talk about this and read your columns and try to sound half as intelligent, but I get some pushback on the December 31st on the Friday, and somebody will say, no, January 1st on Saturday is fine for a CSRS or the second or the third. And I go, I don't think so. I think there's some issue with use, lose, leave. And you can retire on
it's,
a Saturday.
It's not really an issue of use or lose leave, because if you're CSRS, you could technically retire Saturday, January 1st, and you would still be in the 2010 leave year. So you'd still be able to cash out your excess leave. The problem I have with choosing January 1st is that if you retire January 1st, you don't become an annuitant until January 2nd. Which means your first retirement check, payable February 1st, is going to be 29/30th of the month rather than a full month. And you're saying, well, what's the difference, 1 day, 2 days? But, you know, 1/30th of a month for someone whose retirement is $6,000 a month, that's a loss of $200, which why would you want to lose $200 if you don't have to? So if you can retire, close a business Friday, December 31st, you still don't have to come to work that day. It's still a federal holiday. It's still having completed the 80 hours of work for the last leave period, so you could do accrue your last accumulation of leave. So I don't really see any reason to choose January 1st unless you end up with 30 years, 9 months, and 29 days on December 31st. Because those 29 days will be dropped off unless you can somehow make them 30, and retiring close of business January 1st would give you one more day of service credit if you need it. But most people aren't going to have that 29 leftover days.
Okay. This is something, it's slightly more complicated than the Mayan calendar, isn't it?
I think we've made it that way,
well,
Mike.
You know what I find
really
interesting?
Stirred up a lot of
interest. Tammy is the oracle. I mean, everybody listens to what Tammy says and follows it, and you must get a lot of it, because I get some, and people will ask you in good faith, what's the best day to retire? And you say, normally we say January 3rd and or December 31st, but whatever you say, they say, why not a day before or after? And, you know, you're justifying it back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, it's not $1 million, you know, decision.
Yes.
But, you know, for $200, you know, nobody wants to lose $200. It's like dropping it on the sidewalk. But I'll run into people and they'll say, I'm retiring December 31st. And I'll say, how's can we pick that date? And they say, well, you know, it's the magic date. You know, Mike Causey says it's the magic date. I'm like, well, do you have a lot of leave? No, I have 60 hours of leave I'm cashing out. So a lot of people don't even know why they're choosing that date. It's just that they've heard it over and over again. So I think we should add to it that if you're not saving up your leave the last year, if you're not trying to cash in 448 hours of leave, then it may not be necessarily any different retiring December 31st rather than January 31st or April 30th, you know, whatever day you want to choose, or even pick April Fool's Day if you're CSRS. So the main motivation for someone to choose the end of the year is when someone's really trying to make the most of that lump sum payout of their unused annual leave, because it can be a substantial payment. You figure if it's 448 hours, which includes the leave you carried over from the year before plus the 208 hours you can earn the last year that you work, and this is assuming you don't take any, which wouldn't work for me. I have to take a vacation. But, you know, a lot of people will go that last year with foregoing any annual leave vacation, so they save it all up and they cash it out. And it could end up being a check for $20,000 or $30,000 before taxes.
Well, you know, what you were saying at the introduction, Bob was saying, about the processing has been slowed down. It's taking 6 to 8 months now, and they're blaming it on the Postal Service early outs, which, you know, that's what they say. But having that kind of money in a lump sum might be what tides you over
exactly.
for those 6 to 8 months.
Absolutely.
Because you're getting, what, 60 to 40% of the, or 60 to 20% less than you would normally get, and then you're getting an interim payment on top of that.
Yeah, and if there's any questions about your service credit or if you're due a FERS supplement, that could even be less. So you don't count on getting a partial retirement check that's close to your full benefit. It might be a lot less depending on, you know, what the discrepancies are with your retirement, what issues there are that OPM sees when they open your case. So be prepared.
Yeah.
You know, Tammy, some people listening to this say, gee, I wish I knew this earlier. Mm-hmm. And they would have had they read your columns. And you're way ahead of the game. You wrote about the best dates to retire and not to retire in 2010. You wrote it in 2009.
Yeah, I write it usually a year ahead of time, and then Mike backs me up, and he writes about it. So we're both, you know, pounding it so that people understand that, you know, it's basically common sense, you know, understanding when the leave year ends, understanding how the payroll system works. And so we explain that, both Mike and I both have done, you know, tried to make it clear.
And you've done it for 2011 as well.
We already got the column out for next year.
You wrote it in April 30th, 2010. Now, people say, well, where do I get these columns? And certainly you can go onto our website, NITPINC.com, or subscribe to GovExec. And the cost to subscribe is zero. Gov, GovExec.com.
But I haven't done 2024 yet. I get that question all the time. Can you tell me the best date in 2024?
I'm 18.
I want to plan my retirement.
Well, it is interesting, too, and I think we're human. I mean, we're in the business of looking at pay and benefits, but I think normal people who have real jobs and other things and other priorities, you tend to not focus on these things until it's right upon you. And as a tax guy, I'm sure you see this all the time, that people, you know, every year April 15th is coming around, but people wait until the last minute to...
Truer words could not be spoken. October 15th is the final filing date for people that are on extensions for the year 2010.
Oh, boy.
And it truly makes April 15th look like a holiday. Because you can imagine what kind of returns are in there, the procrastinators, you know, fine people.
And people who just plan. I mean, they don't want to pay it any sooner than they have to. So
right.
They can wait.
Or they don't have it. And you see a lot more of that in the last couple of years because the economy isn't as good, and they're using the money. These are usually self-employed people, and they're just keeping their businesses afloat. And I'll catch up with the taxes. Well, you've got
time
two more weeks.
Hey, speaking of taxes, I know we always talk about the end of the year being a good time to retire, but it seems more and more with tax breaks that you lose after you retire that maybe springtime might be a good time to even think about retiring if you're not all about cashing in the leave, because the flexible spending account is only available to employees. The TSP contributions can only be made by employees. So don't you talk about that sometimes?
Well said. I mean, I really hammer timing of retirement from, and I call it Benny's bucks and taxes. Benefits would always certainly be the foremost. And if you didn't have use-lose leave, gee, the longer you stay on the job, the better, unless you really just don't like your job or you're going off to a second career. Now, I can't imagine anybody in the former situation, but maybe in the second. But like you say, if you stay 3 more months, you could front-load the thrift. If you had the cash flow to do it, you could load up and put the entire yearly amount in those 3 months. You have the flexible spending account, etc. If you go 6 months, again, you got more time to front load the thrift, potential impact on the high three, potential, maybe a better tax deal. So, I mean, there's okay. I mean, one would never retire if you push to it, but you'd say, okay, here's the date, here's the year, how do I maximize it?
Right. And that's the one thing a lot of employees think, they can put their lump sum annual leave check in the thrift, but that hasn't happened.
It has not happened. It's a good question.
It's still pending in the House.
Yeah, and a lot of people are counting on that because they think it's a done deal, but it is not. And given the way Congress is not doing things, it's probably not going to happen this year.
Due to go on recess again for October. So.
Yeah, there you go. And we'll get into this in a while. I woke up this morning to the radio and it said, and I promise you this is true, Congress has decided not to take action on changing the tax rates for 2011 until after the election.
Astounding.
That's just quite a shock, but nonetheless, there's this awful rumor, and we can do this later. Oh, the tax rates are going to skyrocket because the quote Bush tax cuts, end of quote, are going to expire, and you know, just everybody's going to be in tax Hades. But
that's what a lot of people are asking about, the best date to retire relative to the upcoming tax changes that we don't even know what's happening.
We can get into tax theory a little bit. I don't want to put anybody to sleep, but even if they do go up, it's a marginal amount, unless somebody's just really out there with income. And I would say most of our listening audience, if not all of it, are not in that category where they're really going to get hammered. People that have taxable income of $300,000 are usually not retired feds with their annuities. I don't know anybody that high. How about you, Ann?
No, I don't. But could we give our audience a number to call?
Oh, we have a phone number. And, and for those of you listening, we are live. It's 10:18 Eastern Time, September 27th. Don't call us after 10:58 Eastern Time a.m. because we'll be gone. But you can email us. But how about the phone? Thank you, Ann. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. And this is kind of like the lunar eclipse. Take advantage of this. Three of these folks in the same room. Call us and pick our brains. Anyway, so I think we got timing of retirement squared away. But again, much more the benefit in the economics than anything else other than accumulated leave. Let me ask you another question. How does OPM come up with what to pay as a partial amount?
Well, we used to say it was 80% because under the old retirement system, under CSRS, those interim checks, while this is the payment you're receiving while OPM is processing your case. As some of you may know, OPM is still doing processing pretty much on a manual basis. It's not electronic processing. So someone physically, you know, gets your paperwork and your application and all your service history, and they have to file through that page by page, making sure that there's a complete history, evidence of your career from day one to the ending date and everything in between. So it's a very tedious, time-consuming process for the claims examiner. So while your case is on this pending status, you're receiving a partial check. And like I said, it typically was 80% of what your full annuity would be, which would account for the reductions or deductions for insurance and taxes and so forth, which they're not withholding fully until they finalize the claim. But now that we have FERS and we have CSRS offset and we have the relationship sometimes where Social Security gets involved with some of these cases and where people get FERS supplements, I've talked to some employees who have recently retired whose interim checks are about only 40% of what they're expecting their full annuity to be because OPM is still waiting for Social Security for the offset folks or the supplement's not been computed yet and they were counting on getting that. So it does vary. It varies tremendously. Or if there's service in question, if you were retiring and OPM looked at your case and said, well, there's not enough evidence to even make you eligible to retire, they don't pay you anything until they clearly see evidence that you're old enough and you have enough service to retire. So I've known people who didn't get even an interim check initially. But keep in mind, those types of cases are very rare. You know, the majority of people will get the 80% or close to 80% interim payment, but there are some that are less. And as I always say, you know, prepare for the worst. You expect the best, but prepare for the worst because it can happen. And you're not sure, you know, what's the cause of it. You know, you might have done everything right, but yet you're still getting a smaller check.
And let's also be fair to OPM because, yes, it's taking a certain amount of time, but you've come up with some ideas of how to shorten that time by, as an individual that's soon to retire, prepping prior to get the paperwork in order. Better you explain it than I because I don't understand.
But, you know, give notice. You know, don't wake up Monday and say Friday was my last day and hope that your check comes next month. You know, so typically, especially in the larger organizations, you know, like DOD and HHS, you want to give 60 days, preferably 90 days notice that you're leaving. So turn that application in plenty of time, which doesn't mean that it's going to go to OPM next week. It means that your agency has work to do. They have to process your separation. They have to accumulate all that paperwork that they're going to send to OPM. So the agency needs some time to prepare the case to send off for further processing. So if you give 60 to 90 days notice, that's going to mean you're still on the payroll. If there's anything that comes up in-house, they can contact you and say, hey, we're missing this. Do you have a copy of that? And so it can help speed up the case. You know, take some responsibility over making sure that service history is in your official personnel folder. If there's something missing or if there's any questions, you know, try to get those things squared away before you leave. You know, at least get a final estimate.
It's interesting. You mentioned this is still done, somebody eyeballing it as opposed to computers, because that's the way it has to be, looking at these things. But about a dozen years ago, there was a major, quote, scandal that the OPM was delaying these or not doing its job properly. And they tracked it back, and they found out that the agencies were holding them. They would wait until they
got 100. In many cases, that's still the case.
Okay. Yeah. So there again, you have a big agency, and they say, well, wait till we get 100 to send them over to OPM, because they must physically, it's pieces of paper that have to go over.
It's a FedEx package.
Yeah. So that's...
Now, there is sometimes agencies who do electronic processing of the case, and those will get done sooner, and I don't have a list of what agencies are doing it that way and which aren't. So, yeah, some are notoriously slow just getting the whole case to OPM. Some do a much better or more efficient job.
Now, once OPM does, it is kind of like an investigative reporter where they're looking at the files, but a computer does calculate.
Yeah, they have software that calculates.
I'm sure. I'm certain.
And the other thing I want to mention, too, is that just to give you an example, I have an uncle who retired in 1978. So he's now been retired as many years as he worked for the federal government. And I asked him last time I saw him, I said, Uncle Steve, I said, how is it when you contact OPM? Is it frustrating? You know, do you have to wait on hold for 30 minutes? You know, what's the deal? And he looked at me, he says, I don't know. He says, in 32 years, I've never had to call OPM. He says, my check comes every month right on time. I have the same health insurance I had for 32 years, even have the same wife he had for 32 years. So he hasn't had to make any changes to his benefits, which is a good thing that, you know, he doesn't have to worry. His checks come, he pays his bills with that civil service retirement check.
Okay, we have a caller. Sally, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for holding on while we went on and on and on. And I understand you have two questions.
Yes.
One involving a spousal annuity.
Yes.
And, well, you've got two of the best listening to you.
Okay. The first question is, I heard them use the word permanent when you have that reduction made from your annuity so that your spouse can get an annuity when you pass. Is that permanent, meaning if I'm still living and my spouse has died, can I go to OPM and say, okay, my spouse is no longer living, will you stop taking out that money and give it to me, or do they continue to take it out?
Yeah, it is considered a permanent election, meaning you can't just on a whim change your mind about it or increase it or decrease it at any given time. But if your marriage ends through death or divorce, then that election is void, which in your answer to your question, if your spouse were to die first, you would notify OPM upon the death of your spouse, and they would in turn restore your full annuity, so you would stop paying that reduction from that point forward.
Okay. The second question, I heard you mention about that 30th or the first, second, or third of being that date of separation. What if I'm not concerned at all about any saved up leave, which I don't have? Does it matter whether I pick the first, second, third, or the 30th? Because I read somewhere about if the day after you separate is a regular work day for you, then your annuity would start in that same month. Otherwise, it would be the following month.
Are you under CSRS?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, you would look at the calendar, even if you weren't looking at December, which, do you have a particular month in mind?
December. I was thinking of December 1st.
Okay, before the end of December.
Yes.
Yeah, and December 1st, I don't have a calendar in front of me. Do you know what day of the week that is?
I believe that's a Thursday.
Okay, so December 1st is a Thursday. December 2nd is a Friday, which you work a Monday through Friday schedule, right?
No, I work Monday through Thursday.
Oh, okay, then go
out. I'm looking at the calendar now. December the 1st is a Wednesday.
A Wednesday. Okay, and your normal work week ends on that Thursday?
Yes.
Then I would pick that Thursday, because that way you would have finished that week of work. Is it the end of a pay period, December
2nd? Yes, it is.
Perfect. So you'll accumulate your last accrual of leave. You'll get paid for a full paycheck in your last paycheck, which will follow your retirement. You'll get that, 2 to 4 weeks after you retire. So I would pick, the end of the week for you. If your week ends on Thursday, then you will have been considered finishing that week.
Okay.
And then you'll be considered an annuitant the next day. So you'll get your first check would be due January 1st for almost all of December. And the 2 days of December that aren't included in your retirement check will be paid as salary in your last paycheck. So I think that's an excellent date.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
All right. Bye.
Tammy, the accountant in me needs to know this with numbers. Let's say somebody retires with a $40,000 a year annuity, and they provide for a survivor's annuity. So although they were entitled to the $40,000 because they had a survivor's annuity, I'm just using real round numbers, they would be paid actually $36,000.
36,230.
Because you'd get less because you're providing for more.
Right.
Now, if unfortunately that spouse predeceases the retiree, then the annuity would go back up to the $40,000.
That's right.
Okay, I just
yeah. Yeah, and that's something that points out. This is one of the beauties of working for the federal government, because I'll tell you, in the private sector, it doesn't work that way.
I don't even think it does in the military.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, I mean, if you're gone, that's it. You can't say my wife died, my husband died, give me the money. It doesn't work that way. So this is a major perk that the government.
Of course, in the private sector, you might say, "What annuity?"
Exactly, that too.
Right.
Talk to the employee Benefits Research Institute some time ago, and they said that more than half of the people in the private sector don't have any retirement plan, no pension plan whatsoever.
Shrinking every
it's
year.
Social Security and whatever you've put under the mattress,
Moving right along with depressing things, zero COLA again this year?
Zero COLA again. Well, A lot of people have grown accustomed to COLAs, and in 2009, people got a 5.8% COLA, and they think happy days are here again, but that simply reflects high inflation. And what we've had over the last 2 years is almost no inflation or periods of deflation, which we haven't had since 1957, and we didn't have any for extended period until the Great Depression of the 1930s. So deflation is a good thing for a little bit of deflation is a good thing, particularly for federal retirees, because their annuities are not the elevator only runs one direction, that's up. When the cost of living drops, they don't cut their annuities as they might have done during the 1930s. So, but that said, a lot of retirees, they worry about being on a relatively fixed income. They worry about health insurance premiums going up, and I thought they were going to announce those premiums last week. I aired, but they are coming up soon. And Ed Zirndorfer, who works for you from time to time, he's estimating a 5 to 10% increase in health premiums. So if that happens and the retirees get zero COLA, then they will be going backward.
Yeah, because their January retirement check will reflect those increased health insurance rates, and if there's no COLA, there's nothing to make up for that drop. Yeah, isn't it true that the official announcement of that COLA will come out mid-October because it's based on the third quarter index.
That's right. We're it's so far down now that there's almost no. And if it did go up, if they did, for instance, get a 1 or 2% COLA, that would mean we had skyrocketing inflation for the month of September. I mean, it would be catastrophic because they're so far behind the third quarter of 2008, I believe, is the countdown period.
Well, is that the way it works? The third quarter 2010
is compared to
9 is the benchmark, and then if it went up or if it went down by the third quarter 2010, that's benchmark of which.
Right, and this time around, because there was no COLA this year, the actual benchmark, I believe, stretches back into 2008. Oh. But, I mean, it's even more complicated. Mm-hmm. And whenever I write about it, I always put the Bureau of Labor Statistics or the National Active and Retired Federal Employees site up. And I say, let them explain it to you. I go nuts doing this. And if you do, this is the kind of thing, don't try this at home. If you try to figure the Consumer Price Index on your own, you won't be even close. You've got to take the BLS word for it.
There used to be a phone number. I don't know if there was or is now. Now, and you would be able to call BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, and ask for an index. And I remember doing it. I said, which one do you want?
Yeah.
Do you want Detroit? Do you want the eastern United States? Do you want, you know, the stratosphere?
Clerical workers?
Yeah, and so there's just a multitude of
right. It's CPI/W/U, I think. Mm-hmm. But they do have any number of them. That's right.
Okay.
And the other thing to add to that is that the employee pay raise is not linked to the BLS.
Yeah.
Employee pay raises, I always called it a congressionally motivated, politically motivated pay raise.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's entirely up to the politicians, the White House and the Congress, and has nothing to do with inflation, nothing to do with the cost of living. And, you know, members of Congress and a lot of the media are to blame for this because it's just easier to say it's a cost of living adjustment. And when members of Congress get it, they want their constituents to think that they're just keeping pace with inflation when they're totally – one's a horse and one's a cow.
Mm-hmm. Two different things. And I guess because the continuing resolution is probably going to keep those spending bills from getting passed until probably November – so employees won't really know until probably right about the time the pay raise is due whether or not they're getting one.
That's right. Yeah, they're on track for 1.4%, and one of the appropriations committees has boosted that, I think, to 1.9. But I think they'll be lucky this year to get
any.
1.4 in January of 2011.
Mm. And there's some members who want a furlough of federal
employees.
They're
talking about 2 weeks furlough, talking about a 10% pay cut for members of Congress and their staff, and there's all kinds of things out there. And while a lot of this may be the sky is falling in stuff, it's in a session like this, a situation like this, where they're talking about major political changes, and you're going to have a lame duck Congress with probably a lot more lame ducks than usual in it, virtually anything could happen.
Okay, now for those of you all listening, we're talking about discussion items, not past legislation.
Absolutely.
Because you hear this in class, well, the prior speaker said this, and mm-hmm. I go, we train not to say things like that,
yep.
And then you'd have to just move on. Mm-hmm. Now, talking about moving on, and I guess we'll get all the bad stuff out here. I don't know that this is bad. 2011 tax rates. And this is what I do. So I read these things, and finally one day I was just kind of frustrated. I said, somebody had to have made some type of projection as to what these rates would be. And I go, they couldn't have produced the budget without knowing what they would expect income tax revenues to be using 2011 tax rates. So I just Googled it, and it printed out, and actually it's, you know, and here it's the last page in our papers. And I found it extremely interesting that, and again, this was just what they used in the budget. This is not passed, but it shows the mindset. And they basically didn't touch anybody unless their income was rather high. And in fact, some of the high ones, they had a very small decrease. Now, the real high ones were going to have an increase, but they left the lowest bracket alone. They let the second bracket alone, they let the third bracket alone, and then they let the fourth bracket alone for the most part. And in some cases, they cut it. And I was kind of happy to see that at least somebody had this. Now, this doesn't mean that it's going to pass. But you would think that in today's political world, and I'm not a political beast by any stretch of the imagination, they're not going to raise the tax rates on the lower end or the middle end. That's who they're trying to appeal to. And if somebody is going to get nabbed, it's going to be at the upper level. But where is that demarcation is the question.
Yeah, it's part of this to pay for health care reform, possibly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there were some other things, medical itemized deductions on one's return. And you know, if you look at medical another way as a tax deduction, you only hope you never qualify for it because it has to exceed 7.5% of your income in order for you to get $1 worth of deduction. Well, that's going to rise to 10% in 2013 to help pay for healthcare.
Yeah, I've got a question for the wisdom of the crowd here. Starting now, or starting in 2011, a lot more people are going to be eligible for membership in the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program. 26-year-olds, and they don't have to be dependents. You could have a son who's 25, married with a child, and you could put him on your federal health program.
And that's even if his job offers benefits, which has gotten a lot of people angry.
You wonder the motivation of that, because presumably his wife and child will still need health insurance on their own, and they'll have to have a family plan from somewhere. But there's been some speculation that adding this group of people may add to the costs. And Ed Zirndorfer on the show a couple of weeks ago said he thought it was going to raise the premiums dramatically. In the federal health program.
See, Walt Francis thought the opposite.
Well, I would have thought these are bringing in relatively young people. Mm-hmm. But I think the other school of thought is you're bringing in young people, but these may not be the healthiest of the young people.
The ones who maybe can't get
insurance.
They
may be coming in for different reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, we won't know, and it would be, I'm having lunch with an insurance executive later on the week, and I'll put that question to them. But the major changes coming up in the federal health program, that's the first one. And then coming up later on, they're going to have limits in the over-the-counter drugs. They'll have to be prescribed in order to be eligible, with some few exceptions. And then also they're going to, I think in 2013, they'll be cutting back the flexible spending account. And that's too bad because, they're cutting it in half from $5,000 to $2,500. And that's at a time when many people are just becoming aware of what a good deal an FSA is.
But in a way, I think it might push more people into using healthcare savings accounts, which are not being cut back. But to be in a healthcare savings account, you have to enroll in a high deductible health plan. So this open season, I think if employees are smart, they'll pay attention and read what's changing and maybe redesign their course on what they, what they would find as their best health insurance, because it might not be what it was this year.
And that healthcare savings account, high deductible means I switch to a plan and I pick up obviously more of my costs for the year. But once that's hit, then I can start using a savings account?
No, you can use your savings account to meet your deductible. Once you hit your deductible, it turns into regular health insurance. And depending on which plan you're in, they may pay 85%. You'll pay 15%, just like you do with Blue Cross or any other plan. And the other benefit to that, even though your deductible, let's say for self only, might be $1,500 before you can start receiving health insurance, half of that deductible is typically paid to you back in the form of rebates of your premium. So if your monthly premium is $160 a month, you might get $120 of that back in a rebate that goes into your healthcare savings account to meet your deductible. So I think people should look at those, especially if you're looking for a tax shelter, because when you put money in your healthcare savings account and don't spend it, you still have it next year. It's in a bank account. It's safe, perfectly safe.
It's like an IRA.
Yeah.
If you never use it and become very healthy, it just grows.
Yeah, and down the road when your health maybe does develop chronic illness or take a turn for the worse, you have that money saved up so that you don't have to take it out of your monthly retirement income. You take it out of your HSA and pay for those out-of-pocket expenses. So I think it's a win-win situation if employees would take the time to learn more about it.
When you present this in class or talk about it, do you get a pushback by saying, when you hear high deductible, it sounds like, I'll never be able to meet this and I'll have to... Do you find that in the class?
Well, I give the example and I add to that how you get the premium rebate. So once I explain the whole circle of it, a lot of employees are taking notes and saying, where do I find out more about this? I think they just didn't realize that. I think you hear that and you think, it's meant for the young people who are not sick and don't have any kids. But I find that I've read about the statistics of who's enrolled in these, and it's mainly mid-career, high-salaried employees because they're looking for a tax shelter while they're still healthy, and then it's the ability to set aside money for the future for their healthcare needs. And from, I think I read this in the IRS publication on HSAs, that you can use that money to pay for your long-term care insurance.
Yeah. Well, and it was either OPM or the Government Accountability Office, but somebody did a study of the people that are in these health savings accounts, and as diplomatically as possible, they said, these are the smartest people in government. You know, I mean, there's a lesson
the
there.
Taking the time to study
yeah.
it, right.
I would think also even the younger ones, how good would that be? Because they generally are healthier, and they're putting money aside in a tax-deferred account to hopefully never use. But if they do use, they can build up a whole lot more starting early.
And you can use them in retirement. The only condition is if you have other health insurance like Medicare, you can't contribute to the HSA. So the goal is to get the money in there before you turn 65, and then you can use the HSA as a health reimbursement arrangement, meaning you can still spend the money, you still get the rebates, but you can't add any more to it. But for someone who retires at 55, you still have 10 years you could make contributions even if you're retired.
Okay, let's do our phone number again because there's only about 18 minutes left to pick y'all's brains. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Okay, health care reform, FEHB, we did that. Current federal legislation, I suppose we could spend days on this, but what would be the one that y'all would bet has the most, the highest probability of passage?
I would say none.
You know, Other than maybe that TSP bill that's going to allow you to put your lump sum leave check into the thrift.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, offset the
cost, the administration. I mean, President Obama has said we should be doing this. Everybody should be doing this.
Plus, they do it in the private industry.
And, yeah, right. And in the TSP, it has to go through Congress. Mm-hmm. But you know, again, with this agenda, I mean, when you look at, without being cute here, when you look at what they've done this year, they being the House and the Senate, it's not very much. I mean, they haven't passed any of the 12 appropriation bills, and they've just been preoccupied with the election. So going to be, as we say, a very interesting session, what's left of it, and then a lame duck session.
They sure did enough prior to, though. I mean, the bills, and I'm just looking at it from my small little world of taxes. In the last 2 years, every bill that came through had some tag-along tax thing.
You've had to keep up with all the changes.
And you had to keep up, and you just, you know, after a while, you shrug your shoulders. I don't know if one of the provisions in one of the bills, and I think they've decided to pull back on it, is to, for a business owner to have to file, you know what a Form 1099 is, so that you get at the end of the year for interest, or you get it for investments or dividends or something, but you'd have to file one for everybody you wrote a check to. And businesses.
Crazy. Well, that's the same with what Mike was talking about, needing a prescription for over-the-counter medications. I mean, to me, that's going to add to the bureaucracy and the paperwork rather than eliminate it. So I don't really know the purpose of that.
The IRS, I have not looked at it yet, but the IRS has on its website, there's a place you can go, and it lists the drugs that you can and can't get. And I mean, you talk about getting down into the weeds and minutiae. And, and if this is done properly, if they obey the law that the law of the land, this will require a lot more eyes on these things. Yeah.
Well, and I remember some, the over the counter medicines could no longer be taken out of your flexible spending account or your,
I'm
babbling here. Yeah. You all
well,
would
some
know
things
better than
still
I.
can't. I mean, the over-the-counter Band-Aids and things you buy like that, you can still get reimbursement even into next year. This is just over-the-counter medications that treat an illness, allergy medication,
cough medicine. If you used to be able to take it out of the FSA, now it has to be prescribed by a doctor. So that's again, that's added paperwork and possibly added cost to you. If you visit the doctor and he says, okay, I'll give you this cough syrup, but he may send you a bill for that.
OPM put out some notice last week or the week before, and this is related to the covering your children, your adult children who are over 22, because, you know, a lot of employees are asking, how do I do that? You know, I know it's becoming law, but how do I get my child under my plan? Well, if you already have self and family coverage and you're not going to make a change during open season, then come November, I'd say wait till the end of November, contact your carrier, whether it's Blue Cross or GEHA or Kaiser, and just let them know your child's name, that you want to include them back on the plan, and that's all you need to do. It's not anything you'd have to do as an open season change. But if you're in self only, then you want to pick up self and family. And for those who have SAMBA, because SAMBA offers already a dependent child's benefit that covers your kids up through 26, that benefit's going to end December 31st. So if you have SAMBA health coverage, you'll have to put that child back on your SAMBA family plan.
Okay, we've got caller from Boston. Kathleen, good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I have a question. Tammy, you said that the best day to retire was December 31st.
Right.
My question is, if I retire on December 31st, will I get paid for the January 1st holiday?
You will, because you're going to be retiring. When you put that date on your application, whether you're CERS or FERS, you retire, technically close a business that date. So you would be considered an employee on December 31st, which means payroll will include that day as your last payday. So you will get paid for the holiday.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right, because the holiday is the 31st.
Right.
If the holiday itself falls on a Saturday,
then that Friday becomes the federal holiday.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I just learned so much being around you two. Jennifer, we have Jennifer on the line from Texas. Good morning, Jennifer.
Good morning. Hi. My question is regarding the three paydays out of per month, and then trying to retire April 29th or either May 3rd. I want to know which day would qualify me for that three paydays in that month. I know May.
What day of the week are we talking about? What's April 29th?
April 29th is Friday.
It's a Friday. Is it the end of a pay period?
It is at the end of a pay period.
Okay.
But in May is really when the three paydays come. But I wanted to leave that first week of May and be able to capitalize on that first full payday.
Sure.
So I wonder if I have to go through the third, and would that still entitle me to that three payday?
Okay, so if April 29th is a Friday, then the 30th is Sunday, then May 1st, 2nd, and 3rd is going to be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, right?
3rd is a Tuesday.
Tuesday. Okay, so I don't see any real benefit to staying through May 3rd other than getting a couple of more days of salary instead of retirement pay. And you are CSRS, right?
I am.
Yeah. So I would say pick April 30th if you want, or May 3rd. Either one of those is going to be okay. It's not going to make much of a difference in your last paycheck, because it's not going to take you through the end of a pay period by retiring May 3rd. So I think either one, whatever one works best for you, I think would be okay to choose.
Okay, and then I want to make sure the annuity will start the following month on the first day if I...
Right, you'll become an annuitant either way. Whether you go out April 29th or May 3rd, you're still going to become an annuitant in May, which means your first check would be June 1st or the month of May, because you're always paid as a retiree on the first of the month for the previous month.
Okay.
So you'll get your first probably interim check on June 1st, and then eventually OPM will catch up and pay you the full annuity.
Okay.
But if she went out on the 3rd of May, she would get a prorated
Yeah, the first
the
one would be
salary,
prorated,
which is better.
Yeah, it'd be fine, and her last paycheck would include salary for those days. So that's why I said it doesn't make a whole lot of difference, you know, which day. The only other thing I'd recommend you do is get a final annuity estimate from your agency so that they can project your sick leave through that date and look at how many leftover days you're going to have. Because if you have, you know, 28 days left over on April 29th, then of course you want to work a few more days to make that another month, because every month adds a few dollars to your retirement check.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So get them to run you a final estimate for that date. It's time. I'd say now's the time to request that.
And start saving money, too, because if you heard earlier, there are delays in processing these and getting your full check, and it could be 6 to 8 months before you'll be getting
a
full
check. Yeah, I'm hoping by then they might have rectified a lot of that. But, yeah, be prepared that it could still take
a while.
And
from a tax perspective, since you will be on the job from January through whenever you are going to leave, if you had the desire to put a lot of money in the thrift, you can actually max out your thrift by the time you left. Of course, it might cut down on your eating habits for those months, but that would be beneficial. And watch this legislation, see if it passes, that your accumulated leave could be put into the thrift. Mm-hmm. So a lot of nice things.
Yep. I think springtime's a nice time to retire. Mm-hmm. Weather's getting nice all over the country. So
yeah, there's nothing we talk about magic date, but there's nothing magic about December 31st or January 3rd.
You wake up every day in January to snow
exactly,
if you're in the northern part of the country.
Yeah. Pick the time that's best for you and then work around that.
To go outside and
okay.
Work
Thanks for calling, Jennifer. All righty.
Texas, Boston, D.C. Not bad.
Yeah.
This is like the old days back at this show when we get calls. Live calls. I thought everybody listened online, so this is a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, very. But they do listen online. The spike goes up. The station is just terrific. It gets us on about noon or 2 o'clock after we're done the show, and then Monday night, it just boom.
And it's on the radio Fridays too. As I've turned on, I said, "Oh, there's."
Yeah, they broadcast it a significant number of times during the week, which is nice, and we appreciate that.
Absolutely,
good folks to us.
Anyway, you were talking about legislation, and the one thing I've observed over the 22 years I've been doing this training is that a lot of us fear, they're going to change the high three to the high five, or they're going to move the retirement age to 72. But, the reality is the legislation that actually passes into law generally are improvements. They're usually not things that take benefits away, because you have to think in terms of, if you're a congressman or woman, that you don't want to make federal employees angry with you. So if there's anything you can do to protect and preserve their benefits, you're going to look out for the people who support your work. And so I found that, a lot of these changes are actually benefits and improvements.
And this is like the line from Casablanca, round up the usual suspects. Every year we have the fear of going from the high three to the high five, and fear of furlough, and fear of changing the formula, and all that. And it's always out there, but it has not happened yet.
It could happen. It could be the boy who cried wolf.
Right.
I have the high none. Anyway, we have a caller on the line, Dean from Idaho. Good morning, Dean.
Hi, quick question on FSA. If I retire on December 31st, is my 2010 FSA, am I eligible to use that clear to March 15th, or does it shut off on January 1st?
It's going to shut off the day you make your retirement effective. So any money that you have left for the 2010 FSA has to be incurred. You have to incur the expense. You have to go to the doctor, have the bill prior to your retirement date. So make sure you spend any leftover money. Otherwise, you stand to forfeit it. So that March 15th date goes away on the date you retire.
Great. That's good to know. Thank you.
You're welcome. And for information on FSA, the website is fsafeds.com. And where you'll find a lot of these answers is in their frequently asked questions. And so that's another resource employees can use.
Okay. Thanks, Dean. All right, I got a question, Tammy. I've heard this, and I believe it to be true. Let's say somebody retires at the end of January, early February, and they are involved with the FSA, and they put the minimal amount in for the month that would equal the total for the year, but they're going to retire. Can they then have a medical procedure, dental work, or whatever in the month of January equal to the full amount of what they would have put in for the year, but they didn't?
Yeah, I don't want to encourage employees to do things, but I have to tell both sides of the story, because just like we said to Dean, that if you leave money in the FSA account and you've retired, you forfeit it. It's gone. You don't get to see
it. It cuts both ways.
Yeah,
I always do that in class,
So let's say the other caller, I forget her name now, she was going to retire April 29th. Let's say that she decides to sign up for FSA this open season. She says, I'm going to put in the whole $5,000, because we can still do that for 2011, 2012. So she puts in the $5,000, which is going to be spread equally over 26 pay periods. And she's leaving around pay period 10 or 11. So she won't put in the whole $5,000 by the time she retires. But if, for instance, she decides to go have two crowns and a root canal and LASIK surgery in January, and she spends the entire $5,000 and submits the claim, she'll get reimbursed up to her $5,000 limit, usually within a week of her claiming the expense. And so when she retires April 29th, if she hasn't accelerated her payments and she just retires and she's only made 10 contributions, maybe only put in $2,200 of the $5,000, they can't get the money back. She will not be obligated to pay the difference of what's remaining on her payments. So it's a little loophole there in the tax.
And
law.
I imagine the people who run the FSA in Louisville are jamming this broadcast even as we speak.
Because I even asked that at a conference one time, and the guy said, "Yeah, I'll answer that, but see me at the break."
Yeah.
You don't want to say it in front of the whole group. So I hesitate to say that, because it sounds like I'm promoting you to do something you shouldn't do, but it's in the tax code, so why should some people hear about it and others don't? So
no, I got the question years ago, and to be frank, I said, I just can't imagine that would be the case. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I called you, and you go, yeah, it is the case, Bob.
And it's in those frequently asked questions, but it's buried.
But I did call the person back, because I got their phone number, and I said, I'll give you an answer. But again, if you weigh the other for the people that would lose it, so it kind of has a balance.
It does have a balance, I guess, yeah. Maybe that's why they're cutting it back to $2,500 in 2013. People are catching on to that loophole.
Well, and it brings a lot more revenue, potential revenue, into the Treasury, too. If everybody was going to have a $5,000 account, and now they're taking it back. I'm not a mathematician, but maybe that's a 50% increase in the revenue that they can't evade, leave out of taxes.
Yeah, and yes, who knows where we're going with the taxes. I think we're going up, but again, at the higher level. And just I'd like to say a little bit about tax rates. People, I'm not saying they don't understand. I think I was born doing this stuff. But if you go from one bracket to another, oftentimes people think when you go to the higher bracket, they go back and retax all your other money. But it's not. It's like walking upstairs. You know, you come into a place and the ground level is low. And then you walk up to the next stair and it's higher. And then you go to the next stair. But they don't throw you back down the stairs.
Right.
And I'm not saying that higher taxes people should greet with open arms, but, you know, if they happen, it isn't that they're going to retax all the other money.
Right. The other thing, Mike, you wrote about this, I think, today, didn't you, about the new, possibly new TSP investment options?
Yes, yes.
And how this has been happening through history.
Right, yeah. Congress has authorized them to study this, and the board that runs the Thrift Savings Plan and the union employee management groups, that the advisory committees, they're both split on this. But the idea is some people want more options. The people want a gold fund. They want a Russia fund.
Or socially responsible.
And there's interest in it. But the people who want it most are the mutual funds out there, because $2 billion a month is coming into the government, and they'd like a piece of that action. And, you know, we had various proposals for a dot-com fund the year before the dot-com market crashed. Remember REITs,
the real estate, and they kept
saying it has nothing to do with the housing market.
Right.
It's commercial real estate. Well, it does have something to do with the housing market. If you have a recession, you have a recession. But there's still people that want it, and my guess would be that eventually down the line they will open a window. They'll pick a couple of mutual funds, mm-hmm. and they'll open a window for, you know, a very limited period of time and a limited amount of money you can transfer out. And I was telling somebody one time, they did that for us at the Washington Post. We had a Vanguard plan, which was superb, the lowest rates in the business except for the TSP. But they let us take some of the money out in a window and invest it on our own. And all of us, every one of us that did it, and I'm one, we did worse on our own than by narrowing the focus. We got into a Russia fund that did very well briefly, and then it didn't. South America fund and that kind of thing. So I would advise people to be careful of what you want, because you may get it.
All righty, we have just a minute and a half or so left. Final comments, Mike?
Well, could have been worse. This is the year the fact that retirees aren't going to get a COLA is too bad from a health insurance standpoint, but prices are generally lower than they were 2 years ago in a variety of things.
Tammy?
I guess life is complicated. Ask good questions.
Yes, and we were very pleased to get the calls today. We like questions.
We love the callers.
I mean, that's what we live on.
Makes our life more interesting.
Yeah. And I guess I'm just the tax guy and just watch the papers, but I don't think we're going to see a tax increase for far and away the bulk of folks. Income tax. Somebody said, what about sales tax? What about jurisdictional tax?
Yeah, state tax.
Can't help you there. Wish I could. And
next week, that's the hot topic. It's you and Ed Zirndorfer talking about taxes.
Oh, boy.
Oh, that should be a hot one.
It always is.
Ed is always a treat, and he digs out stuff, and you go, really?
And he'll talk about health insurance, I'll bet, too.
I bet he will.
I'll bet so.
Anyway, thanks for listening, you all. Please tune us in next week and keep up with the calls. I was very impressed. Everyone was outside the Beltway.
Idaho, Boston, Texas, not bad.
Idaho, what time do they have to get up to listen to this? Anyway.
Not that early.
Anyway, thanks for listening, and thanks y'all for being here, and we'll be back next week, same time, same station. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.